From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In July 2003, 2 months after Saddam Hussein's statue fell in Baghdad and with no weapons of mass destruction in sight, a former U.S. ambassador named Joseph Wilson wrote an op-ed piece suggesting the Bush administration had sold the nation a phony cause for war. Within days, in what looked like retribution, someone told the press that Wilson's wife was an undercover CIA operative. This week, or soon, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald reveals whether he thinks that leak or its cover-up was a crime. The Vice President's Chief of Staff, Louis Scooter Libby, and the President's Chief Political Advisor, Karl Rove, are in the hot seat. Indictments may be on the way, or may not. But Washington is on fire with anticipation and interpretation of what's unfolding. This hour on Point, the CIA leak case comes to a boil, and the Bush White House braces for possible indictments. You can join the conversation. What's your take on the Valerie Plame leak and possible indictments? Is this special prosecutor overkill? Is it crime and just punishment? Is it a window on a wag-the-dog campaign to mislead the nation to war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin with the latest from Washington. I'm joined from Washington by Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, good to have you. Thanks for being there.
Good morning.
And John Dickerson joins us. He is chief political correspondent for Slate. John, welcome.
Hello, Tom.
John, can you take us first through this moment that we're at? Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald has until the end of this week, sort of, because the grand jury that's been impaneled will be disbanded then, or could be?
Well, it's supposed to be disbanded then, but then again, he could fire up a new one. But no one seems to expect that. And the special counsel has ominously put up a website preparing all of us as if we weren't already at the edge of our seats for some kind of announcement to come this week.
Is there any sign that he's made up his mind? The New York Times reported on Friday that he wouldn't do that until sometime this week. Is that the way this process normally works? A special prosecutor waits until days before the sort of more or less deadline to decide?
Well, each special prosecutor is different, and we've had lots of guesses about what he's going to do. A lot of the guesses that was supposed to come last Wednesday, a lot of people thought that didn't happen. So it's not really clear what he's going to do, and no one really seems to have a good idea yet. But again, the end of the grand jury's term gives some indication, and then the production of this website gives some notion that we might be headed into something this week.
Karen Tumulty, what's the atmosphere there in Washington as the White House and the assembled ranks of pundits and onlookers watch this thing about to unfold?
Well, you know, Tom, considering that this is an investigation of a leak, one of the great ironies is how leak-free it's actually been. So what you find in Washington are lawyers talking to lawyers, reporters talking to reporters. It's as much of an echo chamber at this point as it is real information coming out. I think that Mr. Fitzgerald has been remarkable in his ability to keep his own counsel. So what everybody does is they sort of make suppositions based on questions he might have asked this witness or that witness. But the fact is, you know, everybody is just, you know, pretty much in the dark until we find out what actually happens here. Now, I've been told that, you know, if there are indictments, that the targets of those indictments will know that before the rest of us do, probably mm-hmm. the night before. So I suspect the news at that point may leak out.
Karen, remind us of why so much attention is now focused on Louis Libby and Karl Rove.
Well, in the days after, and actually we now find out in Judy Miller's testimony, even the weeks before Joe Wilson,
reporter, yes. mm-hmm.
Before Joe Wilson wrote his op-ed in the New York Times, that there was a lot of interest in the White House as to just, you know, who this former ambassador who was showing up in news reports was, who had was challenging the administration's assertions of weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. And Scooter Libby, it turns out, spoke with both Judy Miller of the New York Times and possibly several other reporters on this subject. And Karl Rove spoke to Matt Cooper of my magazine, Time magazine, mm-hmm. and also to the person who first wrote her name, who is Bob Novak, a columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Now, this is a possible violation of an old law that prohibits disclosing the identity of covert operatives for the CIA. But it is a law that has very rarely, in fact, I think it's only once been actually prosecuted. It's a very, very hard law in and of itself to bring charges on. So now there's a lot of speculation as to whether, if in fact there are charges, they will not be on this underlying law, but perhaps on either perjury or conspiracy. Once again, the old Watergate axiom that it's not the crime, it's the cover-up.
And that may be what's going on here. John Dickerson, we've seen these two men pulled in multiple times to testify. Can we read the tea leaves of the number of appearances before this grand jury and the timing of those appearances that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby made to try and project forward here?
Sure. Well, and that's essentially what we're left with is tea leaf reading because, as Karen mentioned, this has been an extraordinary investigation in that it's been so leak-free out of the special counsel's office. This is why these number of appearances, and particularly Karl Rove's four appearances in front of the grand jury, suggests that the special counsel is trying to get the story straight here, and so too perhaps are the witnesses. This is what leads everybody to think that somewhere along the line, a story was told that didn't turn out to, strictly speaking, be true once the special counsel found new information from either Matt Cooper of Time magazine when he finally spoke or Judy Miller of the New York Times when she did twice. That's what makes a lot of people think that it's at least a kind of a perjury or something having to do with the actual investigation into the initial potential crime as opposed to anything else. But then we've also had a lot of speculation about a conspiracy that goes back long before most of the public ever heard of Joe Wilson about spinning the Iraq War and the case for the Iraq War in a more programmatic way within the administration.
We'll look at that. Karen Tumulty, already in advance of whatever Patrick Fitzgerald does, and of course this is an aggressive prosecutor out of Chicago who's got a pretty upright reputation on all sides, put in there by the Bush administration under pressure after this leak to look at this. There's a lot of discussion that already this has had a significant impact on the Bush White House, that Karl Rove has been more or less sidelined by the necessity of defending himself, that Scooter Libby is under a kind of scrutiny he's never faced before. Can you feel in White House operations from, I don't know, Katrina right forward, the absence of these men or their distraction?
Well, the place where it has been pointed out to me more than any other is in the handling of the Harriet Myers nomination for the Supreme Court. A number of people that I have talked to in and around the White House say that one of the reasons that this has gone so rockily for the White House has been that Karl Rove, who would normally have handled this rollout, who would have dealt with all the interest groups on the right in particular, essentially was not sort of operating under full steam. And as a result, it was left to other people and, you know, coming in sort of part-time.
And John Dickerson, you write that if Karl Rove ends up having to be taken out of the White House, the man famously known as Bush's brain, your headline, if the brain is removed, it's going to hurt. How likely does it appear, if indictments even come down, that the president would remove Rove? Is that a foregone conclusion?
Well, we have some hints that that's, in fact, Time magazine, I think, was the first that reported that Karl has already sort of planned to step down if he's indicted. Republicans I've talked to, both just in the chattering classes in Washington, but also officials on the Hill, think of it as a foregone conclusion. If someone's indicted, they've got to go. Everyone here in Washington seems to think that that's going to be the case. And we should all remind ourselves of what President Bush, then Governor Bush, talked about in the 2000 election, which was setting a new kind of standard for White House behavior. That it wasn't just what was it wasn't just what was legal or not legal. It's what was ethical and what met the higher test that he set for the White House. Now, he campaigned on this, of course, because he was running against all of the difficulties President Clinton had, and he was trying to and successfully tarred Vice President Al Gore with those difficulties. But the president, then governor, made a steady case during his campaign about installing a new sort of cleaner White House. And so arguably, even if there aren't indictments, he will have a tough time sort of squaring those past remarks with whatever the special counsel comes up with.
Karen, we're going to take a break in a minute here and come back and look at kind of the master narrative behind this investigation, the differing sort of stories being told here. But certainly on many fronts, that squeaky clean promise looks very distant right now. The Bush administration's poll numbers lousy and being assailed on many sides on just this issue of how upright the government's been.
That's right. And that's is not just in the White House, but also on the Hill, where you have had in the last few weeks Tom DeLay having to resign his office as majority leader in the House because he was indicted in Texas. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist is also under some ethical scrutiny these days.
So there it is, a big, broad mural. We don't know what's going to happen later this week, but you hear the anticipation right now, and it all goes back to the very beginnings of a very big deal. The nation going to war. We're joined in this hour by Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate. We're looking at the CIA leak investigation coming to a full boil and the White House bracing for possible indictments this week. You can join us. What is going on with the Bush White House? How much more of this centrifugal force can it take? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What's your master narrative of what's underway here? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the CIA leak investigation coming to a boil and the White House bracing for possible indictments this week. We're joined by Karen Tumulty with Time Magazine. John Dickerson of Slate is with us. You can join us as well. What is your take on the Valerie Plame leak? Was this Rove and Libby maybe simply trying to clarify a murky situation? Was this just extreme Washington hardball? Was this part and parcel of taking the nation to war on a lie? Do you want to see indictments? Do you trust this prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Karen, what about the big narrative here? We're reading the Wall Street Journal this morning saying, come on, this is just a political practice in Washington, you know, as practiced, attacking the credibility of a political opponent. They label former Ambassador Wilson, this should not be a felony. On the other hand, in the New York Times, you've got Frank Rich saying this is the keyhole on a vast conspiracy to take the nation to war under false pretenses. Who's winning the narrative battle here?
Well, you know, it's funny because it's sort of like they're both right. I do think that the real issue here is the reasons, the justification for going to war. But the fact is, if you were to take any of these transactions that we now know about between administration officials and journalists and, you know, subtract the fact that it was a covert operative that they were talking about, it is sort of business as usual in Washington. In this case, it's business as usual that may have violated a law.
So both true, John Dickerson. It's hard for those to live side by side, but I guess they could. Explain to us how it came to this point. President Bush presumably didn't have to put Patrick Fitzgerald on this case. How did it get down to such, you know, short hairs when it's so close to the line of being typical behavior?
Well, and again, we don't really exactly know what Fitzgerald has been looking at. And so I would agree. It looks very much like typical behavior. In fact, you could make the case that if Karl Rove was out launching a smear campaign, it was the weakest and limpest smear campaign we've ever seen him produce. Some of those of us who've been on phone calls with Karl when he wants to get a message out, we know we're just the first in a long line of telephone calls. And in this case, it looks like the total universe of people he talked to about this is two. And that's just not, you know, the way they usually do it when they're going out to really nail someone. And we forget also that this was a pell-mell response to Wilson. Half the White House was over in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It was a real scramble. And so those who think that, well, he only made two phone calls because this was a precision attack, that's just not likely to be the case. It'll be very interesting to see exactly what this was a part of, and whether it was just kind of throwing yet another piece of data to knock down Wilson against the wall, or whether this was a more programmatic and systematic effort to smear him. But getting back to your question about the special counsel, the CIA actually asked that this be looked into, and this is a part of one of the strands of this narrative, which is that the White House, or certain portions of the administration, I should say, have been in a long battle with the CIA over the intelligence that led to the war. And you'll remember when this Wilson memo came out, ultimately what happened was that CIA Director Tenet fell on his sword publicly about the 16 words in the President's State of the Union address, admitted he hadn't read the final copy and that it was his fault those 16 words ever made it into the speech.
This goes back to the yellow cake, the so-called makings of a bomb that were supposed to be in Africa but weren't there, and they stepped away from that claim the President made in the State of the Union address.
That's right. And in fact, if you look at the claim the President made, he actually said that the British, I believe, still stand by this, British intelligence had reported that Saddam had tried to seek yellow cake in Africa. And but that's essentially what the White House withdrew, and Tenet took the blame for that, saying that it's his fault and it should never have gotten in there. And that was just another round in a really ugly fight between members of the administration and the CIA over intelligence, the quality of the intelligence, and it's a fight that's gotten even uglier now that no stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction have been found.
And, of course, we've learned post the invasion how tortured some of that intelligence was, and many reports mounting of how deeply involved the White House and Vice President Cheney in particular were in pursuing the intelligence that turns out to be wrong, or at least misrepresented. A lot of listeners want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Mark is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. What do you think?
Good. I definitely think that this whole thing is about an effort to conceal the misrepresentations that led up to the war, and I think that there were two participants in that effort. One were the administration officials that I suspect and hope will be indicted this week, but the other was the news media that really fell down on its job. There was a lack of critical reporting. In some cases, I think there was aiding and abetting, and I think that's certainly the case with Judy Miller in the New York Times. I don't believe that Mr. Dickerson's take on this is the right one, which is that this was a weak effort to smear Wilson. I think clearly the effort was there to smear him. I think what happened was they switched tactics very quickly when they saw that wasn't sufficient, and they instead had George Tenet fall on his sword, at which point they went off in a different direction. But to give an example of what I mean by the news media, I think in recent days you have seen the news media again failing to do its job, because you see a round robin of attacks on Wilson for things he never said. So, for example, that he claimed falsely that Cheney sent him to inspect this situation in Niger. He never claimed that. And yet I see individual after individual come and make that claim unchallenged by the host of whatever show they're on.
Mark, let us pick that up, because it clearly is a case, John Dickerson, I'll come to you, Mark's poking back a little bit here. It's clearly a case that the whole relationship between the press and the White House, or the leakers, whoever they were, is part of what is illuminated by this prosecutor's spotlight, whether he's looking at the media's role here or not.
Oh, it's absolutely true, and there were areas where the press fell down, and certainly Judy Miller's reporting, the New York Times is still trying to recover from some of that. One of the things that's interesting is that as we look at the administration here, the critics of the administration who charge bungling and excessive incompetency on a whole range of issues and ongoing serial incompetencies in Iraq, nevertheless, on this case, seem to think that they had excessive precision and knew when to caper and when to move and shift when half the White House was in Africa and half was in Washington, with with sort of precision guided only, you know, that we've never seen in Washington before. I think what we're more likely to see out of Fitzgerald is sloppiness, and sloppiness after the fact, as these officials were perhaps trying to backtrack or figure out what they were engaged in after the investigation started.
There's one view of it, though we see another which sees this as much more deliberate and really afraid of this as the thread that would unravel a whole kind of false cloth of justification for the war. But Karen Tumulty, our caller really puts a spotlight on the press and says the sloppiness or responsibility isn't just in the White House lap, if it's there, but the press was kind of playing ball here in a way that made it very hard to keep lines clear and facts straight.
Absolutely, and there has been a lot of soul-searching on the part of the media since then. I mean, we are, in the beginning and in the end, you know, what we get comes from our sources. But I think that, you know, and at this point, don't forget, you know, even German intelligence thought that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, they opposed the war, but they still thought the weapons were there. So, you know, it's not like the press is in a situation to go, you know, look for the weapons themselves. But we do need to be more skeptical of our sources. We do need to, as we decide whether or not we are going to accept the information that is being provided to us, take a look at our sources' agendas. And I think that has been the big lesson through all of this for us.
Not a good time in the run-up to war to be played like a fiddle. Anne's calling from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hey, everybody.
Hi.
Thanks for covering this. Boy, I hate to break it to you guys. I'm an American independent. I'm an average American citizen.
Yep.
And from here, what it looks like is that the reason there's a distrust between the people and the press is that you guys aren't free. We know that you go to the same dinner parties and cocktail parties with the guys that you cover. How can you be objective when you're worried, like Maureen Dowd, you know, got kicked out of the Washington Press Corps? You know, you got to, at some point, stop being part of the same elite class of the people you cover and start acting like you actually represent the American public. I don't know how you're going to do that. Right now, I happen to be writing a book about this, and I've heard people in the press like Dan Rather lament this relationship that seems to be on the rocks between the press and the people. Well, what you guys have to understand is that we perceive you out here in Americaville as part of the same elite as the people you're covering, and we're getting tired of the business where you have to have access to your sources, and the only way to do that is to play the game their way.
So no more playing footsie. And let me ask you, does that leave you hoping for indictments here or not, as a clarifying thing or not?
Well, to my mind, oh, this is what my point was. I'm sorry. My point was that the fact that any of you would say this is business as usual and that's okay, it's not okay. It's not okay to go after somebody because they're pointing to the truth. Yet the fact that the administration does itself no favors, it undermines its own credibility by not being able to accept and work with the truth.
Period, end of story, as far as you're concerned. And Anne, we appreciate your call. Waiting to join us from New York, and I want to bring him in, is Daniel Richmond, professor of law at Fordham University, a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, 87 to 92. He worked with special prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. Daniel Richmond, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
You heard the caller just there saying, this can't be, this isn't, or shouldn't be business as usual. How do you think Patrick Fitzgerald is looking out on this whole giant picture right now?
I got to say, one of the things I celebrate most in the way Pat's run this investigation is that I don't know how he's looking out. I know what defense lawyers have told me is the subject of his investigation or the way he's proceeding. I don't know anything about what Pat actually has, what he actually believes. I think what's really been laudable on his part is how quiet he's run this. He's kept his head down among all sorts of swirling accusations, and we'll see what he has or what he wants to do shortly, I suppose.
What can you tell us about his approach, his style, his stick-to-itiveness in the face of a challenge like this? Tremendous pressures around him this week. What kind of prosecutor is this?
This is, of all the people I know who I would like to trust with making hard judgments about sensitive issues, Pat is within the top five. He is somebody who has his entire career kept his head down, did his job, in terrorist cases, in organized crime cases, in corruption cases. I don't think anyone who's worked closely with him, or even anyone who's been an adversary, can say that he has an agenda or that he goes anywhere but where the facts take him.
And what about the way this case is defined and looked at? The Wall Street Journal saying today, come on, this was just people in a political arena attacking the credibility of a political opponent. At the same time, Patrick Fitzgerald's job is to apply the law here. Is he going to allow fudge room because that's the way it's been done in Washington, or is he going to be a very exacting applier of the law?
I got to say, I'm not a big fan of the everybody does it, so it can't possibly be illegal school of thought. We heard that when insider trading was pursued by the U.S. Attorney's Office way back in the 80s. We hear that from time to time in accounting fraud. We hear that from time to time in every single white-collar case. Thank God we don't hear it for rapes, robberies, and murders, but the fact is once you get out of the basic index crimes, there really is a risk that whoever's ox is being gored is going to say, well, everyone does this sort of thing. If everyone does this sort of thing that involves the leaking of classified information for political gain, as seems to be alleged here, it'd be nice if we started cracking down on it.
And if he doesn't or can't prove that central allegation here, is he the kind of guy who's going to come back with a fine-tooth comb on perjury, obstruction of justice, on internal contradictions of the testimony of Rove or Libby or others?
Well, certainly from the very beginning of this investigation, and he had this point made explicit in his delegation from Deputy Attorney General Comey, Pat Fitzgerald's charge really runs to looking not just at violations of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, but also violations of the various obstruction statutes. These aren't spitting in the street violations. These aren't detours. We take obstruction of justice incredibly seriously. There aren't that many prosecutions of obstruction of justice standing alone, in part because in many cases the punishment for obstruction gets rolled in with punishment for other crimes. But the fact is Congress has legislated at great length in the obstruction area, and certainly when it comes to obstruction at the highest levels of government, I think any prosecutor, and particularly one with the charge that Pat Fitzgerald has, will take it very seriously. So it's not a matter of rolling back and getting someone for obstruction just because you can't get them on a different crime. It's that from the get-go, if one finds that one's inquiry into serious criminal activity is being blocked by people with criminal intent, one takes that quite seriously.
And what about in this week, when it's all come down very likely to a handful of days in which he's likely to decide and announce his decision, is he subject, Daniel Richmond, you know him and you know that world well, is he subject to pressure of any kind, to, I don't know, a midnight phone call from someone powerful, or is that just completely out of bounds, doesn't happen?
I gotta say, maybe somebody will call me a too Pangosian. I can't imagine anyone interfering with him at this point, given the sensitivity of the investigation and who Pat Fitzgerald is. I can't imagine that, A, anyone would trouble him, and B, that if someone had the temerity to even go near him, he would be in any way affected by it. He is keeping his head down. He kept his head down when the newspapers were calling him overzealous. He will keep his head down when other people call him misguided.
Karen Timothy, I know we've just got you for half a minute here. How do you see the consequences for the Bush White House, indictment or no? How serious? How big a wave coming at them here?
Oh, it could not happen at a worse time. The president's approval ratings are at the lowest point of his presidency. They're down in the high 30s in a lot of polls. His agenda is completely stalled on Capitol Hill. I think what you're going to see is, if there are indictments this week, a big pushback, and Patrick Fitzgerald is going to find himself, I think, probably the target of it. It's not, you know, beyond the pale that not only will people be making this argument that this happens all the time, but also that, you know, we have a system where prosecutors can run amok. So I think that it's, you know, the fight will only begin at that point.
Of course, on the other side, and you hear it from callers this morning, people want a government that acts in a straight-up way, that tells the truth and doesn't hide the truth once it's gone by. Karen, I know we have to let you go. We're grateful to you for being with us. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. John Dickerson and Daniel Richman, I hope you'll stick with us. Listeners, we're talking about the CIA leak investigation coming to a boil in Washington this week. Do you trust the White House to do the right thing here? Do you want to see indictments? Do you trust this prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the White House bracing for possible indictments this week in the CIA leak investigation. You can join us. What is the responsibility here of Bush and Cheney, the men behind Rove and Libby? And do you see conspiracy, corruption here, or behavior you can live with? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined by John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate, with us from Washington, by Daniel Richman, a former colleague of the special prosecutor, Patrick Fitzgerald, now professor of law at Fordham University in New York. Right now we're joined from Washington as well by Michael Isikoff, investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Michael Isikoff, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
You've got a very tough headline here, prelude to a leak this week in Newsweek. It's headlined, Gang Fight, How Cheney and His Tight-Knit Team Launched the Iraq War, Chased Their Critics, and Set the Stage for a Special Prosecutor's Dramatic Probe. When you say they set the stage for the probe, do you mean they broke the law or not?
We don't know, and we won't know until we see what Patrick Fitzgerald's got. But certainly, regardless of what the charges, if just Fitzgerald brings charges or what they are, it's clear that they grow out of the push by proponents of the Iraq War in the run-up to the war to lay the groundwork for the case to be made for an invasion, and that involved a bureaucratic battle with the rest of the other elements of the U.S. intelligence community that were somewhat skeptical of some of the intelligence that was being pushed by Cheney. And when this fight spilled over into the public eye, the very aggressive effort by Cheney's staff, primarily Scooter Libby, to push back and, in fact, undermine not just some of the criticism, but also some of the critics, particularly Joe Wilson.
You paint a picture of that, what you call gang, around Vice President Cheney, the crew that wanted to see this war happen, pushing very hard on intelligence to turn it to that end in advance of the invasion, and then just focusing like a laser on Ambassador Wilson after this piece came out. What's known about what Scooter Libby did once it became known that Joe Wilson was not going to be, along with the music here?
Well, we're learning more as time goes on, but just with Judy Miller's testimony or account of her testimony last week, we really learned for the first time how focused Libby was on Wilson in particular and on the criticism of the nuclear claims. The nuclear claims were, in many ways, the sort of piece de resistance of the case for war. It was, yes, I mean, the intel suggesting that Saddam had chemical and biological had been out there for many years. It was certainly a recurring theme in Clinton administration documents and rhetoric about Iraq. But the nuclear claim was the new element. That's the one that seemed more menacing. The smoking gun. We can't wait for the smoking gun.
The mushroom cloud, Condoleezza Rice.
That one. And that was based on particular pieces of intelligence that were very aggressively pushed by Cheney's staff. And one part of it was the uranium claim that Iraq was trying to buy uranium from Niger. So when Joe Wilson came forward in the spring of 2003, after the invasion, has already taken place, and after Saddam has been toppled, and you know, no WMD was being found.
Yep.
And there was Wilson first speaking on background, then out there in that New York Times op-ed saying this is bogus, and I told them this was bogus. Libby pushed back, and he pushed back hard.
And what are you suggesting in your reporting about the role or responsibility above Rove and Libby of Vice President Cheney?
Well, we don't know. We do know that certainly Vice President Cheney was the most vigorous proponent of these claims, but nobody has yet put his fingerprints on the attacks on Joe Wilson.
His chief of staff, maybe, we'll find out this week, but not the vice president, you're saying. Jerry's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a couple of points I'd like to make. Mm-hmm. One is just a fast one, and I'll try to keep them both brief. Mm-hmm. I was a reporter at one time, and I really got out of it probably because of A.J. Liebling, you know, just convincing me that it was an essentially corrupted environment. It's,
what do you think about this case, Jerry?
Well, my feeling is that I really don't care about CIA people getting caught. You know, I have to be frank.
You mean being
that.
Outed by the government
yeah,
that they work for?
Yeah.
Why? Why not?
Because I distrust the CIA totally. I think they do terrible, terrible things to the whole world.
Okay, so a blanket distrust, so out them if you'll. What's your second point, Jerry?
Well, it was sort of combined, but people were talking before about business as usual mm-hmm. and the press failing to stand up and do their share. But that is what they do. They cover up for the government, and I distrust everything they do. If Clinton could, I wasn't a Clinton supporter, I never voted for him, but if Clinton could be impeached for trivial things like what happened in the White House, essentially happened in the White House, what is this? And nothing, virtually nothing is being said. Now Bush looks like he's got a weak spot, so people are jumping on him. But I don't believe that they're really after him in any serious way. And I believe they'll throw Rove or whoever to the dogs, and that'll be it.
But too late for you and too long coming. Jerry, thanks for your call. John Dickerson, there's that very generalized mistrust coming down from Burlington. I mean, in the president's falling job effectiveness numbers, do you see a trust factor, or is it more just an assessment of, hurricane failure, war trouble, or does it come down to an issue of trust?
Oh, it definitely comes down to an issue of trust. That's been one of the last numbers to fall for him. I mean, there are so many things that make up his low approval ratings, including for a lot of people just the fact that their gas prices are too high. But one of the things that the president could hold on to and his advisors could hold on to when his numbers were otherwise going south was that people still trusted him. Even if they didn't agree with him, people would say, we still believe in him. We still think he's doing the right thing, and he's giving us the straight story. And that number has been in decline since the weapons of mass destruction weren't found, but also more recently. And his really ability to give a speech, tell the country something, and have people believe him without too much questioning has just completely disappeared.
And Michael Isikoff, what about, you described very vividly before the war in Iraq how thoroughly Dick Cheney and the people around him, right on over to the Pentagon and Wolfowitz, were able to kind of, just plow their way through Washington bureaucracy. Once things are in flux like this, does it change the administration's ability to marshal, to rein Washington to its will? Can you feel a difference on that front?
Well, it's interesting because the context and even some of what Judy Miller wrote, referencing Libby's comments about the CIA, the CIA was double dealing the White House on Iraq, on the Iraqi intelligence. There was very much the sense, and I remember hearing it from principals at the time, that the CIA was not to be trusted. The State Department, of course, was not to be trusted.
They thought they were soft, that they weren't going to give them
soft,
the smoking gun.
They were squishy. They didn't have the kind of hard-nosed approach that, especially after September 11th, Cheney and many of his allies at the Pentagon felt were needed to approach all this intelligence. You know, the tendency to look for the on the other hand, for the, well, we're not certain. We can't afford that kind of equivocating was the way they viewed it. And I think that that's very much really the mindset that led to all this. It's perhaps understandable in the context after September 11th, but...
Maybe, but your reporting this week suggests something more, that the claims, the WMD claims themselves, were being stoked in service of a pre-existing agenda that came even before that, that Saddam had to fall to clear the way for a new Middle East and the rest.
Well, that's the sort of broader promoting democracy leg of the stool for supporting the invasion. But, you know, it's interesting. I don't know, George Packer's book on Assassin's Gate on the war in Iraq, he quotes Richard Haass, who was the former policy planning director at the State Department, saying to this day, and he was there during all this party, he doesn't know exactly why we went to war in Iraq. It's never clear when the decision was made. It's never clear exactly which part of the argument was the clincher that pushed them over. Certainly in the public rhetoric, as I said before, the nuclear one was the one that seemed the scariest and was the most powerful. But as we now know, it rested on some of the shakiest intelligence that the U.S. government had, and it was wrong.
But the public case was certainly premised on that. We remember that very well on this show, official after official, people in that circle pointing to that mushroom cloud threat and saying that's the reason. I mean, this brings us to was the country given the straight story about getting into a war that we now see how difficult this war is? Ray's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Well, what do you think?
Well, I was wondering about Robert Novak and what his role is in this. I've always been kind of fascinated by that. Are we likely to find out something on Friday about what he said to the grand jury? And it seems to me that there are two questions. Is what did he know, and when did he know it, and who did he speak to, and what did he say? And that seems to go to the essence of the thing.
It would seem to, and it stayed such a mystery. Ray, thanks for your call. John Dickerson, do you see that coming out as Patrick Fitzgerald delivers his verdict? His indictments are not here?
Well, I'm not sure. It depends what we get from him. If we don't get indictments, there's some suggestion that Fitzgerald may issue no report at all. Or if he does, we'll have to wait for it. Even if he does issue indictments, we'll have to pick through them to see whether there's explicit testimony or interviews with Novak or not. So
is that still a black box? Do we have any idea?
It is one of the great remaining mysteries, although there are so many that we're waiting for from him. But it's one of the great mysteries that the journalist who sort of kicked this whole thing off doesn't talk very much about it and hasn't had to publicly come down on one side or the other in terms of protecting sources or facing jail time.
Daniel Richman, your old colleague Patrick Fitzgerald, under a lot of pressure this week just structurally here. William Kristol in the Weekly Standard writing today, you know what, this is close but no cigar. It doesn't really add up to grounds for indictment, and he should have the courage not to indict. If that's the path that he chooses, do you think, or is it proper for him to issue some kind of report that explains that, or can he just go away without a word and say, nope, didn't find it, sayonara?
If the question is, upon finding that it's inappropriate either because there isn't enough evidence or for other reasons not to go forward with an indictment, is it possible that Pat Fitzgerald could walk away, close up shop without issuing a report? Yes, that's entirely possible. Reports, even though we've come to know them well from Kenneth Starr's investigation, are really an anomaly in our system. They're not something that prosecutors generally do if they're not going to go forward with an indictment. And, in fact, there are good reasons for them not to do it. Obviously, there's great public interest in this, and perhaps there'll be legislative hearings or some other inquiry. But when it comes to prosecutors issuing reports, there really is a problem. They're not. What does the other side do? They can't litigate it. There are no charges. And we find reports very helpful as members of the public, but I think they raise very hard questions about due process that might lead a prosecutor not to go forward with writing anything should he decide not to bring charges.
And yet such big questions, kind of allegations beyond those questions, have been raised here. I mean, the country's going to be standing and wondering, what, how, if nothing comes down, how should that be interpreted? Is it a clean bill of health, Daniel Richmond?
Well, certainly the failure of a prosecutor to seek an indictment and of a grand jury to vote it isn't an indication of anything with any great clarity. It just is just that. It could be because there's no crime. It could be because there's a suspicion of crime but not sufficient evidence, or it could be because there is a crime but it's not worthy of going after. Now, that is an incredibly vague last category, but it's one that prosecutors live with regularly.
Wouldn't that be an awkward moment if that's what it all comes to? But, of course, it could. Kevin is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Hi, what do you think, Kevin?
I wanted to call and concur with the gentleman who said he had an overall distrust for this administration. And I guess the big thing to me is, you know, with the Clinton situation, we went crazy over a moral crime with this guy in the White House. You know, from Guantanamo Bay to now, you know, we don't really know what we're doing in Iraq, or was the information falsified or anything. You know, years ago they would have impeached a president for this. But I guess what really scares me is we're really worried about Coral Rove and Libby. But in the business world, and even in my home growing up, if I did something wrong to the general populace or the public in school, my parents had to answer for it. Or my higher-ups at work have to hire. You know, that's why we have managers.
But that's why we have elections, too. I mean, wasn't last fall's election a kind of the moment for the nation to deliver a verdict on Bush and Cheney?
You know, it really should have been, but if you look overall, we have the lowest voting population of anyone that has the actual right to vote, which I think says leaps and bounds about what the public actually thinks about our government.
And not a satisfactory balance the way you see it. Kevin, we've got it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Michael Isikoff, how do you look at Bush and Cheney as their underlings face so much scrutiny and pressure right now? Is there some way beyond the ballot box in which they could, might be, should be held accountable here, or does it all end with Rove and Libby?
Well, we don't know what. Obviously, we got to look at what Fitzgerald brings, and if he does bring charges, and also, you know, make a judgment as to the severity of them. I think that's another. I think so many people have been so focused on the question of whether they're indictments. They could be indictments, but they could be very narrow indictments, a false statement or a perjury on a couple of accounts that may or may not be viewed by the public as central to the larger questions that people are concerned about. It seems to me that this is a matter that's in many ways would be perfect for a thorough airing of at a congressional hearing or hearings, especially if Fitzgerald does not bring charges, because I think you'll have Republicans saying, you mean you've dragged the country through 2 years of this, you've disrupted the White House, you threw a reporter in jail for 85 days, and you have nothing to show for it, you have no underlying crime that you're able to prove. Republicans may want to hammer Fitzgerald for that. Democrats, of course, will want a full accounting of just what did Fitzgerald find, and who was the original source for Robert Novak. And
this may just be the opening into that. With that, I'm afraid we're out of time. Michael Isikoff with Newsweek, John Dickerson at Slate, and Daniel Richmond, professor of law at Fordham University. We're grateful to each of you for being with us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.